Hey there, and welcome to another episode of Conversations with Leaders. I'm Josh. Inspiration is one of the key ways to transform, and Conversations with Leaders is a bi-weekly interview with industry key players, CEOs, financial authors, and professional money managers worldwide. Get valuable insights from the people who have seen it all. Please remember that this podcast is intended for educational and informational purposes only. Stay tuned for additional disclosures at the end of today's episode. Now, let's get started. And welcome back to another episode of Conversations with Leaders. My name is Josh Gilbert, a market analyst at eToro. Before we get started, don't forget to subscribe to our channel to continue to see these insightful episodes. Today, we're joined by Eberu Coxall, a trailblazer in finance and football, with a decade as CEO of Galatasaray and a groundbreaking role in the European Club Association. Her career is nothing short of remarkable. So let's dive into her leadership journey across both worlds, drawing inspiration from her achievements and lessons learned. Eberu, it's fantastic to have you with us today, and thank you very much for joining. So first and foremost, how are you doing today?
Thank you very much for the invitation. Just arrived last night from Istanbul to Sydney, so still a little bit jet lagged, but otherwise very excited about the interview.
Good. Well, look, thank you for joining us. I know that flight's not easy from Europe to Australia, so thank you for being with us. Eberu, you have got a fantastic background, as we touched on there, one of those being that you studied at Harvard University, which is very prominent in when it comes to sort of education, as we well know. I wanted to ask a little bit about your decision to sort of pursue the management program there and how those experiences there influenced your journey into finance initially.
Well, there is a bit of a fun background to the whole thing. So back in 92, as a second year analyst at Morgan Stanley, like all the other analysts, I applied for business school, and Harvard was my top choice. But my boyfriend, who was living in Turkey at the time, he proposed. I was very much in love, and I withdrew my application from Harvard and moved back to Turkey and got married. So 25 years later, in 2017, I told the family there has not been a single day that I stopped thinking about Harvard. There's an amazing executive education program, which is the equivalent of an MBA. And I said, will you guys do on your own if I go away for 3 months? So that's the backstory to the whole thing. So I dreamt about it for 25 years. And advanced management program was an amazing opportunity to go back to learning after a big, big break, obviously, of 25 years in the industry and in the workforce. And you're together with 170 plus executives from all over the world that work in very, very different industries. My background is 10 years in investment banking, but at that point, the remaining part was in football, basically. So I wasn't quite sure whether my experience would stack up with the, you know, CEOs of global telecom companies or some major, you know, finance professionals. But I very quickly saw that our experience in football is unmatched and unparalleled and prepares us for basically any kind of challenge and builds up resilience and knowledge because, as you very well know, in football, the days are full of surprises, right? We set out the year thinking that your team is going to be champion this year, and then the end of the year is full of disappointments, but we start the next year with the same hope that this year is the one you're going to win your major cups. So the Harvard experience for me was really more about connecting globally with leaders from other industries, comparing notes and understanding the trends in other industries, how they can apply to football, but also get a refreshed perspective on how to build strategy, how to implement strategy, how to build the best governance practices and cutting-edge marketing trends and finance and negotiation tactics. So it was an incredible program for a mid to senior level leader to really add more to their toolbox.
Amazing, amazing. And those that have listened to our podcast here for a while will know that we are big fans of football. So having this conversation today is very exciting. And you touched a little bit there, Ibru, on your sort of background in investment banking. You spoke a little bit about Morgan Stanley. I wanted to ask how that shaped your sort of leadership approach when sort of coming into the football industry, because they don't necessarily always sort of go hand in hand. There's obviously big differences, but there's also similarities. So how did you think coming from that industry helped you within football?
First of all, I think having an expertise area in one of the disciplines, like either it's marketing or finance or strategy, is a very important one for future leadership roles. And among those, of course, my bias is towards finance, because at the end of the day, you can be an amazing CEO, but if you cannot read properly a balance sheet or an income statement, then you are not in the best position to run your operations and your business. So for me, that financial knowledge gave me always the confidence that I can understand what the numbers are telling me, and making sure that the businesses that I build and operate are sustainable, not just for a short term, but for the medium and long term as well. And also during my investment banking career, I actually worked with a very wide range of clients, very different industries, very different sectors. And it was more about deal making, right? Either, you know, selling one Turkish company to an American company, preparing it for sale, or taking one company public, selling it on the stock exchange. But that always required a really deep understanding of different segments, sectors, but also the future outlook and how this company is positioned to really make it the market leader. So I had a very wide range of understanding of different industries, and that discipline of planning for the future actually was a good one that I always used and transferred into my skill sets.
Yeah, and I think sometimes maybe many people that are football fans as well may forget that with their clubs, there is obviously a business that goes on sort of behind the scenes, and there needs to be somebody, obviously, as you say, reading those balance sheets and making sure the business still ticks sort of day to day. And you, as yourself, we mentioned it earlier, were the CEO of sort of Galatasaray. Obviously, that is a huge position in Turkey, one that comes with obviously a huge amount of pressure. Anyone that doesn't know sort of Turkish football, you know, you can have a look to see how passionate the sort of the fans are there. I wanted to ask you what were the sort of the key challenges that you faced, and really how you sort of overcame them, and then what sort of really stood out for you as some of the highlights of your time there?
Yeah, well, I think the first thing was, first of all those years I worked for major multinationals where the infrastructure was amazing, right? You just did your job and everything else was taken care of in terms of ancillary services. But when you go into a club where it's an emerging club which with not that many resources, let's say, you really had to roll up your sleeves and delve in and take care of the day-to-day operations. And that's when you realize end of the month is when you really need to have the cash to pay the salaries and the taxes and the suppliers and everything, right? Prior to that, it was always the theoretical side of making 10-year projections for a business, you know, making assumptions about, you know, how the industry is going to grow and how much market share this company is going to have. But the reality really hits you when you start running a business. So I think that was probably one of the biggest challenges, first of all. Secondly, the brand was a well-recognized brand, an important player in the European football market. But, for example, it didn't have merchandising operations. We didn't have a shop, you know, we didn't have even a scarf to sell. And the total revenues were about $25 million when I came into the club. Fast forward 15 years, when I was leaving, we were at $250 million revenues. So building that revenue base to support a bigger and bigger operation, I think, was the biggest challenge. The fan base was there, but the revenues were not. And then I would say the third biggest challenge was Galatasaray is not a club that's owned by anybody. It is an association like Real Madrid or Barcelona. And every 2 years there's elections, there's a new president, there's new 10 board members coming in. And every 2 years there was a slight change in approach or strategy. And it was very difficult to plan for the long term. So a lot of short-term focus, which means during the 2 years that the term of a president, he wants to be successful, you know, overspends, success doesn't come, and then you're stuck with the losses or the negative cash flows. So planning for medium to long term and creating that sustainable environment was the biggest success. And these are business challenges, but then there are, of course, the discrimination and the prejudices against a female CEO, right? A country so crazy about football and sees it as, you know, a men's game at the end of the day, always questioned why there was a female CEO and what she could know about football. But I think people were failing to see that this is a huge business. You know, football is a multi-billion dollar business and it needs to be run in the same way that any other business is run. So it's not just about what happens on the pitch, but all that's around it is really the important part.
Absolutely. And as I say, I think those numbers that you mentioned there speak for themselves in terms of revenue. You sort of briefly mentioned there about football sort of being still a very male-dominated environment. That is something that has significantly changed in recent years. We obviously just had the beautiful success of the Women's World Cup here in Australia that was sort of seen across the globe and has obviously seen women's football sort of sprung into the limelight. But really, for you, being at those sort of roles at FIFA and at UEFA, it would have, as you mentioned there, posed, you know, a number of challenges, especially in sort of such high profile roles. How did you sort of manage those challenges, you know, as a female in those sort of male dominated environments?
Well, it's a very fine sort of balance, let's say. On one hand, you want to be a change maker and you want to change the long-standing assumptions and prejudices, but on the other hand, you don't want to rock the boat in the first instance so that you fall off of it, right? You need to be in there to really help make the change. So for me, it was first and foremost about performance. So making sure that I do a good job so that men start changing their perspectives on women working in the game and women in leadership positions. So it was almost like if I am successful, then hopefully more women will be allowed in the boardrooms and in the decision-making positions and in the senior leadership teams. That, of course, puts so much pressure for performance. So you're not just performing for yourself, but for, you know, all women to follow after you. And then secondly, for me, it was really about building those influencing techniques and negotiation tactics and coalition building as well. Because at the end of the day, you always needed allies for decisions to pass. And if you're not the ultimate decision maker, if you need the buy-in of your president and board members, then you need to really explain well with facts. And there, of course, my finance background came in very handy. For me, any project, any argument is about feasibility and supporting it with numbers and facts. So I tried to put out the best prepared arguments and cases out there in order for a decision to be taken. And also it's about internal and external networking, really building a network that understands your contribution to the game and also hopefully involves you in the decision making and includes you in all the discussions, because it's very tiring to try and chase down all the conversations that are happening where you're not automatically included. So how to get into the room, but how to remain in the room and contribute, I think for me was the utmost priority.
Yeah, and like you say, that's, you know, really important as well, is to sort of make sure that voice is heard, but also, you know, not sort of trying to knock that door down too early. We mentioned really at the start, Ibru, about, you know, being a trailblazer in football, given sort of the leadership positions that you've held across, you know, such, you know, big names in football, FIFA, Galatasaray, etc. We mentioned the Women's World Cup, and there's obviously a lot of, you know, women who are aspiring to sort of get into the game. From your sort of perspective, what advice would you give to any of those sort of female leaders that are wanting to get into football, but also maybe even finance, because they are both, you know, two areas that are still very highly dominated by male leadership?
Yeah, I mean, there is a widely shared statistic which basically says men, even if they can tick 60% of the requirements of a new job position, would apply, but for women, they don't apply until they tick 100% of them. So that is a significant missed opportunity. I think for women who are wanting to advance in football or in finance or enter the industry in the first place, they need to be less perfectionist and be more confident in their abilities. Even if they don't tick the boxes, they need to think about the transferable skills that they can bring from another industry. But I don't want to make it sound like it's a confidence issue of women. It's, of course, even if you gather the courage to apply to a new role, a senior leadership role, there's still significant prejudices and other barriers that exist. So it's also very important that we have male decision makers who do believe in the merit of having more diverse voices around decision-making tables. And again, it's not just about ticking a box and bringing another diverse person, a woman, you know, in the decision-making table, but making sure that they're making use of their expertise, capabilities, and different perspectives. So it is on one hand a push, upskilling and encouraging more women to apply for these roles, but equally creating the pull from the top as well by convincing each other that blind spots, the best way to get rid of blind spots and groupthink is to bring diverse voices on those tables.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned there about sort of barriers, you know, to entry potentially. And I think you're sort of, you know, making strides in terms of trying to knock down those barriers. Your involvement with initiatives with FIFA, such as the Female Leadership Development Program, you know, demonstrates, you know, that commitment to sort of promoting women's leadership. I wanted just to ask you about the impact of those programs and how, you know, that is helping women, and also is, you know, your motivation there to continue to participating, especially when we're continuing to see, you know, so much conversation around the women's game.
Yes, I think on one hand, some people tend to think women in football and women's football are quite parallel, but they're very different as well. So my approach is always best person for the job. And if it's a man, that's supposed to run, you know, women's football in a certain part of the world, let it be. It doesn't have to be a woman who runs it. But it's about not having prejudices or barriers or biases against one or the other. Flip side, you know, women are a lot of the times told, if you want to work in football, go work in women's football. No, we're making a huge difference and a big contribution on the men's football side as well. But programs as such, leadership courses, mentoring programs, you know, coaching type initiatives, those are extremely important because it gives the ability for women to build peer groups, which is very important. So I call it personal board of directors, right? So that you don't do it alone, but you have this network of women who are on the same boat with you and you're trying to rise all together. But equally, I think the programs allows you to think a bit more strategically about how you position yourself in the game and how to navigate those, you know, political environments and making sure that you have a goal in front of you and try to build towards that goal. So as women, we're amazing agents to, let's say, market, you know, a player, market the brand, market this, market that. But when it comes to marketing ourselves and promoting ourselves, we're usually too shy and too modest. So these programs actually give you a good opportunity to take control of your future and not just go with the flow, but make some very predetermined and preconceived steps in your career plan.
Fantastic, yeah. And I wanted just to talk a little bit about, you know, women's football. We've spoken a lot about, you know, leadership in football as well. And as we mentioned, the growth that we've seen in the last few years has sort of been tremendous. We've seen, you know, fantastic growth in Australian football, obviously with that World Cup, with the Matildas reaching the semi-final of the World Cup in that time, unfortunately beaten by England in that game. I wanted to ask your vision of where you see the future of women's football heading, and if you think that, you know, finance plays a pivotal role in its growth, and what you think is next for the women's game.
First of all, it definitely is the fastest growing segment of football, right? I mean, obviously, relatively compared to men's football, it's tiny, but I don't like making that comparison. For me, it's more about return on investment and the rate of growth. It's exponential. I think the last World Cup was a great testament to how crowds can be really, you know, moved and new audiences will be reached through women's football. But equally, if we wait for the organic growth to take place, it's going to take ages. And therefore, it's very important that we put aside some funds or raise some funds to make investments for growth. Deloitte, as you probably well know, has started publishing the Women's Football Money League as well. And currently in the top 10, the average club revenue is about $4 million. Dollars for a women's football club. Barcelona is at the top with 12, compared to Real Madrid at the top with 700 plus, right? So it still is a long way to go, but now there's more investment that's coming into the women's game by financial investors as well, which is lovely to see. I think Angel City is an example that we all aspire to. Michelle Kang has been making significant investments, and I'm very proud to say that I am involved in a $100 million multi-club women's football investment initiative, Mercury 13. So there are more and more believers that you can actually make a significant return by investing in women's football. And it's expected in Europe, at least, to be the first women's sport to reach the 1 billion benchmark in terms of revenue. So it is a critical period in time, whether it's with broadcasters or sponsors or financial investors, to really consider this alongside their other sports portfolios.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you say, we're sort of moving in one direction, and it seems to be going very fast. And it's going to be really exciting to see how sort of the women's game continues to sort of develop. I think I wanted to sort of wrap this all up and sort of try and cross, you know, both leadership and sports all together. And I think, again, we come back to, you know, potentially the sort of the gender equality in the terms of football and, you know, leadership within even the men's game. What steps do you believe are sort of necessary to try and get more gender equality across, you know, leadership, whether that be finance, but also within football as well?
I think, as I said, it needs the commitment of several different parties, meaning there is some legislation, for example, that's happening in the EU right now. Any publicly traded company is now required to have at least 40% women on their boards starting 2024-25. And that's going to generate, obviously, a pull. But equally, it's not just the boards that we are trying to change, but senior leadership teams as well. So on one hand, supporting this movement with either legislation or quotas, I think, is necessary. But equally, also not just ticking boxes, but creating more inclusive cultures in the workplace is a very important one as well. And it starts from all the way from when you start thinking about a new recruitment, how does your JD reflect that more gender-neutral approach? Where are you advertising? Which pool of talent are you tapping to your interview panel, your decision making and onboarding, and then retention and growth in the organization? So it is a long process, and it's, I think, needs to be seen not just as good business, but something that really improves your decision-making and effectiveness and performance. So for me, whether it's finance or whether it's, you know, football industry or the wider sport, it's about being intentional, and it really starts at the top. So unless the CEO or the chair or the board are convinced about the merits, no matter how you try from inside the organization at lower levels to change things, it doesn't happen. So it's my call to action to all those decision makers out there, really consider diversifying your teams.
Yeah. And look, Ebru, I think you're, you know, trailblazing, as we've said a couple of times, you know, women in leadership and in football as well. And I think it's fantastic what you've done over the years. And it's going to be really exciting to continue to watch your journey, especially with Football Australia as well. But look, it's been a pleasure to have you on today. Thank you so much for joining us and giving us all of your insights.
Thank you, Josh, for your wonderful questions. And I hope the viewers find it useful as well.
I'm sure they will. Thanks again, everyone, for listening. Don't forget to like and subscribe to our channel for more insightful interviews. See you next time. You have been listening to Digest and Invest by eToro. For more information, use eToro.com. This podcast is for information and education purposes only and should not be taken as investment advice, a personal recommendation, or an offer of or solicitation to buy or sell any financial instruments. This material has been prepared without taking into account any particular recipient's investment objectives or financial situation, and has not been prepared in accordance with the legal and regulatory requirements to promote independent research. Past performance is not an indication of future results.